This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump hosted talks at the White House Monday with Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte and said they are both united in their conviction that strong nations must have strong borders. Mr. Conte spoke through an interpreter.
The European Union now has the responsibility to not leave the weight of the management of immigration on the shoulders of the countries of first arrival, like Italy is.
Mr. Trump said he's willing to risk shutting down his government in forthcoming budget talks with Congress if lawmakers don't vote on his immigration reform proposals, including enhanced border security and a system based on merit.
We have to end these horrible catch and release principles where you catch somebody, you take their name and you release them. You don't even know who they are. And then they're supposed to come back to a court case where they want us to hire thousands of judges. The whole thing is ridiculous.
Mr. Trump, when asked about reaching out to Iran to ease tensions, said he's open to talks with his counterpart, Hassan Rouhani. Cited his successful talks with leaders of North Korea and Russia.
Do you have preconditions for that meeting?
No preconditions, no. They want to meet, I'll meet. Anytime they want. Anytime they want. It's good for the country, good for them, good for us, and good for the world.
The U.S. withdrew from the 2015 International Nuclear Agreement with Tehran and is preparing to reimpose sanctions. Vote counting is underway in Mali following Sunday's delayed election. Despite being in the grips of jihadist violence, the country was able to complete a first round of balloting, although voting at hundreds of polling stations had to be halted.
Je ne me prononce pas sur les résultats en eux-mêmes.
Mohamedou Camara, spokesman for incumbent President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, indicated the trend appears to favor his candidate, but a spokesman for rival Soumaila Cisse, among 23 challengers, predicted a second-round runoff will be necessary, scheduled August 12. This is VOA News. The Washington Post reports spy satellites have detected renewed activity at a North Korean facility that produced the country's first intercontinental ballistic missiles. Monday's report comes as the U.S. is engaged in denuclearization talks with Pyongyang. Bruce Bennett is a senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation.
We have to ask, is North Korea just doing business as usual? They're just continuing what they were doing previously anyway. Or are they taking actions that they know the U.S. will see and trying to use those actions to push the U.S. to make more concessions?
The report indicates the North appears to be building one or two new liquid-fueled intercontinental ballistic missiles at the factory near Pyongyang. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Monday announced a $113 billion aid package to countries in Southeast Asia.
These funds represent just a down payment on a new era in U.S. economic commitment to peace and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific region.
Speaking to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Pompeo said the U.S. wants an open and free Asia, not dominated by any one country, a likely reference to China. Macedonia's parliament Monday set September 30 as the date for holding a referendum on the country's new name, as well as membership in NATO and the European Union. Under a deal reached with Greece, the former Yugoslav Republic agreed to change its name to North Macedonia. Greece objected to the original name, which is the same as its northern province. A new Malaysian-led report released Monday on the mysterious disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 4 years ago concludes the Boeing 777's cockpit controls were likely deliberately manipulated to take it off course, but the report failed to identify who was responsible. The flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing disappeared March 8, 2014, leaving one of commercial aviation's great mysteries unsolved. The U.S. Monday said it's revoking the visas of Nicaraguan officials connected to a crackdown on anti-government protesters. President Daniel Ortega faces international condemnation for that crackdown on protests, which erupted in April and led to hundreds of deaths. Congolese opposition leader Moise Katumbi plans to return to Democratic Republic of Congo this week after 2 years exiled to run in December's presidential election. Katumbi, a businessman and former Katanga governor, left DRC May 2016 after being accused of plotting against President Joseph Kabila. The deadline to file for candidacy is August 8. Pope Francis has accepted the resignation of Australian Archbishop Philip Wilson, convicted of covering up sexual abuse of children by a priest. Francis Saturday accepted the resignation of Theodore McCarrick, former Archbishop of Washington, over the alleged abuse of adult seminarians and minors. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting has started in Zimbabwe as the Election Commission looks into allegations of campaign violation.
On 29 July 2018, at least two of the presidential candidates gave statements which were published in the news media which might be interpreted as campaigning. These matters have been referred to the attention of the police.
Priscilla Chikumba is chair of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. A former Ugandan opposition leader says last week's court ruling on presidential age limit has the potential to stoke more violence and instability. Former detainees in South Sudan now say they are willing to sign last week's peace agreement. And Shumalawi's vice president resigned for accusing the president of corruption.
To me, it is the president who is supposed to resign by failing to fight corruption. He has neglected his constitutional duties of protecting the national interest of Malawi as a country.
Vincent Kondwe is a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. Mass failures in the Gambia of the West African Examination Council exams and the World Health Organization on the importance of breastfeeding newborn babies. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vote counting has begun on Monday's Zimbabwe presidential election, the first since a longtime leader, Robert Mugabe, was forced to step down last year. About 75% of registered voters turned out to vote, according to the Electoral Commission. Meanwhile, former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, now the presidential candidate of the People's Rainbow Coalition, has called on the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, NUAZEC, to disqualify both President Emmerson Mnangagwa and Nelson Chamisa of the main opposition MDC Alliance for allegedly breaching the constitution and campaigning 24 hours before election day. VOA Zimbabwe service reporter Blessing Zulu has more.
Dr. Mujuru told VOA Zimbabwe service that nobody is above the law and that the two candidates must face the full wrath of the law.
Both of them are lawyers and they understand what it is when you do things illegally. You know, they stand banned, mind you, if they did that, which we now know they did. They are supposed to be, you know, removed from the race. Nobody is above the law. The law rules every one of us, so we wouldn't want to hear any favoritism about that.
Zimbabwe Electoral Commission Chairperson Justice Priscilla Chigumba told journalists in Harare Monday that the two candidates might have violated the law.
The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission notes with concern continued violations of the Electoral Act by candidates contesting the 2018 harmonized elections. On 29 July 2018, at least two of the presidential candidates gave statements which were published in the news media which might be interpreted as campaigning. These matters have been referred to the attention of the police for investigation as to whether or not the Electoral Act and or the Electoral Code of Conduct may have been violated.
Chamisa and his legal advisor, Tabani Moyo, held a press conference in Harare, reportedly declaring that the MDC Alliance candidate will win, and if Chamisa does not win, it will be because the election was rigged. But ZEC has come under fire for referring to Mr. Chamisa by name and refusing to do so with Mr. Mnangagwa. ZEC acting chief elections officer, Mr. Utoile Slaigwana, told the state-controlled broadcaster ZBC that the commission had reported Mr. Chamisa to the police, said Slaigwana, and I quote, "The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has noted with concern the violation of the Electoral Act, Chapter 213, by one of the candidates contesting in the 2018 harmonized elections." Slaigwana added that this matter has been reported to the police for investigation on possible infraction of the electoral law. But responding in a press statement, Mpofu said his client has not breached the law as alleged by ZEC. He added that the fact that ZEC has reported a non-offense at this crucial time is meant to intimidate the president, Chamisa, and his team in an acceptable demonstration of partiality and will not be viewed lightly. But late Sunday, Mr. Mnangagwa also posted on his Facebook a rebuttal to former President Robert Mugabe, who had vowed earlier in the day not to vote for him. Mr. Mnangagwa, in a video on his Facebook page, urged people to vote for him and his ruling party.
"Now that it is clear to all that Chamisa has forged a deal with Mugabe, we can no longer believe that his intentions are to transform Zimbabwe and rebuild our nation. The choice is clear. You either vote for Mugabe under the guise of Chamisa, or you vote for a new Zimbabwe under my leadership and ZANU-PF. Real change is coming. We should all be part of it. God bless Zimbabwe.
ZANU-PF Deputy Legal Secretary and former Justice Minister Fortune Chasi told VOA Zimbabwe Service that Mr. Mnangagwa announced on Saturday that he had finished his campaign when he addressed a rally at the National Sports Stadium in Harare. Chasi says the video was just a rejoinder to the press conference by Advocate Chamisa and former President Robert Mugabe. He said it did not amount to a campaign. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, this is Blessing Zulu in Washington, D.C.
Four-time former Ugandan presidential candidate Dr. Chisa Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change says last week's court ruling on presidential age limit has the potential to stoke more violence and instability in the country. The justices ruled to lift presidential age limit, making it possible for 73-year-old President Yoweri Museveni to seek a sixth term. Dr. Besigye says the age limit provision was put in the 1995 constitution to engender stability and a peaceful change of government, considering that there has never been a peaceful transfer of power in Uganda. Besigye says the Ugandan parliament is a powerless body that is used repeatedly by President Museveni to perpetuate himself in power.
The ruling that came out of court was not surprising at all. In fact, it was expected that the extension of the term of parliament, which was obviously outrageous, would be knocked down by the court, but that they wouldn't touch the more crucial and decisive element of it, which is the age limit of president. Now, it has to be made very clear that power in Uganda does not really reside in parliament. Parliament is a tool of Mr. Museveni. It was used in this case to exactly do what Mr. Museveni wanted, which was to create an opportunity for him to rule for life.
Dr. Besigye, President Museveni on Monday came out criticizing the judges in the ruling they made about the term limit for the members of parliament, saying, in fact, they focused too much on procedure and not substance, suggesting that 5 years does not give members of parliament a lot of time to do the work that they are supposed to do.
Well, I think it's simply a crocodile tears. Just like I have pointed out, Mr. Museveni was never interested in the extension of the term of parliament. It was certainly not his initiative. It was not the initiative of anybody. It was just a negotiated settlement in order to allow him have his life presidency, which was extremely unpopular in the country. And so Mr. Museveni is just posturing to try and show them that he sympathizes with them, but certainly he is happy with the judgment.
You have contested elections for the presidency in Uganda for many election cycles. What does this do to the whole process of moving democracy forward in Uganda?
Now, what that amendment did, the removal of the age limits from the constitution, is that it broke the structure of the constitution itself. Because that constitution of 1995 was made against the background of Uganda's history, where no leader had ever handed over power to another peacefully. So the main thrust of that constitution were provisions that could engender stability, that could engender peaceful change of government. And there were two vital provisions to that extent. One was the term limits, two terms to the presidency, and the other one was the age limit. The term limits was struck down in 2003, and that was when Museveni had already served his two terms. He struck it down, again using a parliament that indeed betrayed the population. And now that his age was approaching the limit, he he again has used the parliament to strike down the second provision. So what it means for the country is really that we have now overthrown the constitution, that Mr. Museveni can now continue to govern as he wishes, and that therefore raises the question of whether this may not incite another round of violence and instability for Uganda.
Dr. Besigye, it's always nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Dr. Chisa Besigye is a four-time former presidential candidate of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change. You're speaking with me from the Belgian capital, Brussels. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 31st. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Malawi's vice president has refused to resign from office despite pressure from the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, to do so. Instead, Saulos Chilima says he will not be harassed to abdicate his mandate as a vice president. His latest remarks came after Information Minister Nicolas Daoussi called on him to resign. The call followed Chilima's ongoing corruption accusations against the government of President Arthur Peter Mutharika. For the latest development, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Vincent Kondwe, a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi, in the capital, Lilongwe.
He is quite very right, because the electoral arrangement in Malawi for electing the president is that you elect both the president and the vice president jointly. Now, whenever they are called to resign based on political differences, that is not a valid argument. Probably if they won't, they should raise an argument where the people themselves should decide that maybe the vice president should be impeached. That could be the only way of removing the president. But asking him to resign on the basis of political differences, there's no legal basis for that call from the government spokesperson.
The issue of supporters of the president, for that matter, the ruling DPP, is that, morally speaking, if you accuse the government of graft and ongoing corruption in monumental proportions, then it is fair to say you will dissociate yourself from them and then go and challenge the president like he wants to do in the next year's election. So why be part of the government that you accuse of wanton corruption, they said?
Well, there are two sides to it. Once you are elected the vice president in Malawi, after your tenure of office has come to an end, there are lifetime benefits that the office of the vice president has received from the government coffers. So the vice president maybe is aware that once he resigns, then he loses all the pension and all the benefits that are accruing to him as the vice president. Secondly, here is a vice president who has clearly stated that he tried to fight corruption from within the system and had informed his boss, who is the president in this case, that the levels of corruption are very high in the country and can we be able to fight corruption? And he says that he has felt the president did not act on his advice. So to me, it is the president who is supposed to resign by failing to fight corruption. He has neglected his constitutional duties of protecting the national interest of Malawi as a country.
Do you see the ruling party moving impeachment proceedings against the vice president? And do you think it will be politically advisable, looking at how problematic it could be ahead of next year's election?
There are only 9 months ahead of the next year's elections. It's too late to start impeachment procedures now and convict the vice president. And again, there are no legal basis from which the president can be impeached. Because remember, the founding president of the Democratic Progressive Party left the party, the United Democratic Front, which voted him into office, and formed his own party while in government, which is currently now the Democratic Progressive Party. So I don't see any basis on which the president can be impeached. Two, I do not think the ruling Democratic Progressive Party would have the two-thirds majority in parliament to impeach and indict the vice president. So it's an impossibility.
Vincent Kondwe is a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clote from Lilongwe. The former detainees who refused to sign South Sudan's recent power-sharing deal reached last week in Khartoum now say they will sign it. The group had said they didn't agree with certain provisions of the deal, but now they say they will endorse it before a final peace agreement is signed next month. Michael Atit reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The former detainees and the South Sudan Opposition Alliance declined to initial the power-sharing deal last week because of their opposition to retaining several newly created states and other provisions in the Khartoum Agreement. Alor says his group believes the proposed Independent Boundaries Commission won't be able to consult with ordinary South Sudanese at the grassroots level to gather their views regarding the number of states within the eight-month pre-interim period. But Alor says the former detainees have agreed to sign the deal to enable the talks to move forward for the sake of peace in the country and address the outstanding issues later.
The mediation will guide us on the way when we could sit as parties with the help of mediation so that we resolve the issues which have been bracketed. The most important is that all people are going to sign, but with reservations which are going to be bracketed.
Alor says the Sudanese mediators have assured the opposition that some of the outstanding issues could be bracketed and move forward to the next round of talks. He says his group wants to make sure the South Sudanese people are aware of the concerns of the former detainees, including their doubts over the credibility of the proposed referendum to resolve the disagreement over the numbers of states.
Within the 5 months, you cannot conduct a referendum. Because who is going to be responsible for that referendum? It is the current government. The rest will not be there. So we are saying, no, this is not possible. So we are going to, maybe, if we don't agree, we will bracket it and go ahead.
He says the former detainees have also shared their concerns over the power sharing at the state level with the mediators, which he says should be inclusive.
The government is talking about 65% for them and 35% for the opposition. We are saying no, it should be 55 for the government and 45 for the opposition. And the opposition will now divide the 45% among themselves.
Alor says, despite their opposition to parts of the deal, his group remains committed to restoring peace across the country in order to end the suffering of citizens. He's urging the South Sudanese to monitor implementation of a revitalized peace agreement.
I hope the people of South Sudan this time put a lot of pressure on all of us so that we implement the agreement and so that we avoid a return to violence and so that we focus on issues of resettlement, issues of rehabilitation, and then later, of course, we move to the development of our country.
Repeated calls and text messages to South Sudan Opposition Alliance's spokesperson, Kwajel Lasso, for comment on this story went unanswered. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
In the Gambia, almost 90% of the students who sat for the West Africa Examination Council WAEC Senior Secondary School Certification Examination failed most of the subjects, particularly mathematics and English. As Pandere Umbai reports, Gambian scholars are warning the results may represent a decline of Gambia's education system.
Over 13,000 Gambian students sat for this year's West African Senior Secondary School Certificate Examination. Over 45% of the candidates were male, while 54% were female. The West African Examinations Council says 475 candidates obtained credit passes in 5 subjects and above, including English language and mathematics. WAEC also says there has been decrease in pass ratio compared to last year, when 530 students obtained 5 credit passes in 5 subjects and above. Dr. Ismail Asise is a political science professor at the University of the Gambia.
The results are saying that the education system is really faltering because I think over 90% of the students who sat the exams didn't have the 5 credits that is needed to even enter university, meaning that over 90% basically failed the exam. Compared to other countries in the sub-region, if you look at Nigeria or Ghana, if they have 30% pass rate, for them that's a failure. And this has been happening for the past couple of years, especially in the subjects of maths and English. Gambian students are failing.
The exiled Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh has been credited for building numerous schools and hospitals in the country. though the two sectors have been underperforming for a while. Dr. Ismail Assise says lack of quality education could partly be blamed for the appalling results.
It's a combination of factors. One is that during the previous, in the past 10, 15, 20 years, the Gambian government have been investing more on the hardware of education, that is building schools. They've been focusing more on quantity rather than quality. And they've not been investing more on the software of education, that is investing in teacher training, investing in money into the education system to attract the good brains into the education system.
CISA also says lack of decent salaries and incentives is impacting on education in the Gambia. He says Gambian teachers are poorly paid, hence many are leaving the profession. Musa Ba is an English teacher at Nusrat High School, but had a different view on the students' poor performance in this year's WAEC exams.
Well, the factors are many and varied. It can go from government policy to WAEC and the way they write their questions, the teachers, the students, parents. It's complex, but all these factions are to blame in some way or the other.
The Gambian government, under the leadership of President Adama Barrow, has developed a national blueprint document called the National Development Plan, NDP. The NDP seeks to address the country's key developmental challenges, such as education, health, agriculture, among others. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pande Rimbaye reporting.
The World Health Organization says infants who are not breastfed within the first hour of life are at greater risk of death and disease than those who receive the nutritional benefits of their mother's milk soon after birth. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva the launch of a joint study by the WHO and the UN Children's Fund.
The World Health Organization reports that breastfeeding babies within an hour of birth significantly increases their chances of survival. Data from 76 countries finds that breastfed infants get off to a good start because mother's milk is rich in health-giving nutrients and antibodies. Yet, WHO's infant and young child feeding specialist, Lawrence Grummer-Strawn, tells VOA only 40% of infants are breastfed in the first hour of life.
The delay of breastfeeding puts the babies at increased risk of infection and ultimately increases their risk of death. Just delaying beyond the first hour can increase mortality by about a third, and waiting till the second day doubles the rate of mortality.
Grummer-Strawn says the worst rates are found in East Asia and the Pacific, where only 32% of babies are breastfed in the first hour after birth. He says the numbers are much better in Africa, where Eastern and Southern Africa average rates of 65%.
But what's interesting is this varies tremendously from country to country. As we look across Africa, you can see some countries that have very low rates, as low as 20%, but other countries as high as 90%. Similarly, in Asia, a substantial difference from one country to another country in these rates.
Grummer-Strawn says the difference in rates is not driven by regional patterns. He says it is mainly driven by the kind of education and medical care prevalent within a country. The report warns that formula or other drinks must not be given to newborns unless absolutely necessary. It says formula can be dangerous because it sometimes is mixed with contaminated water and delays the infant's first critical contact with his or her mother. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Tuesday, July 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.